From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
In a recent phone call, today's guest, Tim Johnson, used the phrase bioproductive gardens, and it stopped me. What does he mean by that, I thought, and then he explained. There are ways to manage our landscapes, he said, so that everything that flows through them, from rainwater to birds, leaves healthier than when it arrived. Tell me more, I replied, and so that's my topic today with Tim, the new leader of the longtime conservation organization called Native Plant Trust. More in a moment, but first, these messages.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Walcott, Vermont, offering 30 new seed varieties for 2024. Professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
Tim Johnson is the new Chief Executive Officer at Native Plant Trust, which was founded almost 125 years ago as the nation's first plant conservation organization and the only one solely focused on New England's native plants. Tim, with his extensive background in environmental horticulture and biological science, recently led the Smith College Botanic Garden, and I'm so glad to get to talk to him today. Hi, Tim, how are you? And congratulations, of course.
Thank you. It's really great to be here with you.
Yeah. So new job. Getting acclimated. You've been, I guess, since what, late January, maybe you've been in the position?
New job, week 7. And I do keep saying, though, I feel a little bit more like I changed offices than organizations. Native Plant Trust was a close partner when I was at the Botanic Garden. And it's a team that I've really looked up to and been fortunate to have in my professional network for many years.
Yeah. Well, and as I said in the introduction, Native Plant Trust, which was founded as New England Wildflower Society almost 125 years ago, I think, is a conservation organization focused on New England plants. But sort of for people who might not know, kind of give us the, how do you describe it when you tell people what the sort of mission, what you're doing there, what the emphasis is, you know, all these years later at this place that's so, so historic?
Yeah, that's a great question. Native Plant Trust is an organization that is so much more dynamic than I understood from the outside. The most important programs are conservation, horticulture, and education. And we really work at a regional scale to fulfill all three of those departmental visions and missions. So our conservation program does a great deal of work coordinating efforts throughout a region, working with state, local, nonprofit conservation professionals, as well as community members. We do a lot of work with the general public on rare species monitoring. Our horticulture program works in the woods, but they're also really influencing the way we garden and think about landscapes throughout the region. And then our education program does a mix of in-person and virtual, as well as multi-educational programs that are happening at different sites throughout New England.
Mm. So you said that the horticulture, a lot of it's focused at Garden in the Woods, your sort of headquarters. Is that?
That's right. Garden in the Woods is one of our properties. We also have Nisami Farm in Western Massachusetts, as well as sanctuaries throughout New England.
Right. Yeah, and it's the cusp of spring, and for gardeners who are within reach of New England or are going to be visiting the area or whatever, I mean, definitely a destination, both Nisami Farm and Garden in the Woods. I mean, and if you like to shop for native plants, it's even a double destination, not just beautiful places and places to see these glorious things, but lots of wonderful, you know, you're propagating native plants and selling native plants, and so there's a lot to engage with is what I'm trying to say. Must visit. Put it on the list of must visit, right?
Yes. And in particular, we really strive for the plants that we're selling to come from locally adapted seed sources. And so
Yes.
our take even on seed sales is a little bit different because rather than cloning plants, rather than working from cuttings, we're trying to be working from genetically diverse populations.
Right. So bioproductive gardens. You really threw me, as I said in the introduction. I just didn't know the phrase. And so tell us what that means to you and why you sort of threw that out to me as something you wanted to have on my radar.
I have to share the credit for the idea with a colleague of mine, Dana Weisbord, who I worked with at Smith. And it came up in the landscape master planning process that we co-chaired at Smith. And when we were trying to figure out what is the common denominator for managing our landscape, and we had all these ideas about reducing fertilizer, reducing petroleum inputs directly, direct and indirect, trying to really create a healthy environment, we landed on this idea of bioproductive landscapes and the idea that why, if we almost think about it, if we think about our built landscape as an extension of nature, we really should be focusing on the ecological processes that are facilitated within these landscapes that are in our urban and suburban environments.
And so, one of the things you said to me when we talked the other day is that the idea that everything that flows through them leaves healthier, whether it's water or a bird, as I said in the introduction. Now, so tell us a little bit about examples of that, about what you have sort of what's in front of mind if you're going to be a bioproductive landscaper or gardener. You know, what are the elements and the organisms that you have in mind? Is it from microbes up to mammals? I mean, what
Yeah,
is, yeah. And is
absolutely.
it both living organisms and resources, so to speak, like rainwater?
Yeah, it is a holistic look about the abiotic and the biotic. And so when we an interesting thing, at least in my head as a gardener, happened when I started to think about, oh, can I garden in a way that's bioproductive? Is I started to question the use of some traditional practices. So, for example, would I be willing to use insecticides for problems? Sometimes we face really, really difficult problems as gardeners. And I became less and less willing to do that because I didn't like what it was going to do for the microbe communities. I didn't like what it was going to do for water. I became concerned about incidental damage, for example, honeybees and solitary bees visiting my garden. And so I stopped doing that. The other thing that I've really come to embrace with this methodology, with this, maybe it's more of a philosophy, is to really work with what I have in my space. And so rather than, I'm on a very, very sandy lot. It does not want to be a lawn. And if I try to keep it as a lawn, I'm going to have to put in a lot of water. I'm going to have to put in a lot of fertilizer. And it's going to be a lot of lawn mowing as well to manage it. But if I start to think about what would like to be here in this very sandy soil, I can start to work with the environment. And if I want to actually change it over the longer term, I can bring in nitrogen fixing plants. I can start to slowly enrich the quality of the soil. And there again, it's enhancing rather than consuming the landscape that I'm gardening within.
Right. So really then kind of every step of the process, the plant palate, any other inputs, whether it's like you were just saying, if an insecticide or something like that, the use of any material that you'd be sort of bringing in, or any natural resource, you're really sort of figuring how to do it in the most beneficial and conservation-minded way. Is that kind
That's
of,
right. I think
yeah.
one of the principles I've really come to embrace comes from restoration ecology, where if we kind of look at what is dysfunctional in a habitat, we might be able to actually address that and then have a much more autogenic garden, right? So again, if I have very, very sandy soil and I'm putting in plants that really do not want, if I were to try to plant an apple orchard in my soil, it's going to be quite challenging. I'm going to have to constantly fertilize it, right? Not to mention we have problems with fire blight and things like that. But I'm growing in this soil. Amelanchier grows really well here, actually. It's very happy, and so that's also an edible fruit. And so thinking much more dynamically, and even thinking about the tools that we're using. And so at the garden, moving to electric chainsaws, making sure that when we're putting chain oil onto the saw, we can actually use cooking oil. We don't have to use petroleum-based oils on that. And embracing kind of this much more of a cradle-to-grave approach of thinking about how we're doing good with the garden. For me, I think about people moving through my landscape and wanting them to feel perfectly comfortable and know that they can eat food afterwards, or they don't have to worry about their kids walking on the lawn or touching the plants, because they can trust that they'll be healthier when they step through it as well.
Right. Now, you have a sandy soil, you said, and so like the shad bush, you're just talking about, or what do they all call it? Also service berry or
Yep,
June
service
berry. All
berry.
these, it has
Yep.
so many different names, I think, right?
Right.
So that would work for you better than some of the larger fruits, like, and that's a native plant, that would, than an apple tree, an apple orchard or something like that. And so you're doing research on plants that are willing to grow, that are adapted to a sandy soil and so forth. And so that's one part of it. And are you like, I sort of think, and I've had a couple of conversations recently with experts in whatever we want to call ecological landscaping, or there's so many different people use different language to describe it, and I call it sort of habitat style gardening. Are you visualizing for this yard of yours? Are you visualizing a habitat that you're creating? Are you do you have a do you know what I mean? Are you mimicking anything in nature in your sort of master plan, or is it more you're looking for individual plants that will work? What's the sort of bigger picture? Or,
Yeah, that's a great question. For me, my backyard is a recreation area. It's also a very sandy area. And so when I look at my landscape, increasingly, I'm trying to think about how I can create a aesthetic and functional facsimile of this native habitat. I kind of have this idea that eventually my house would gets plunked into this sandy prairie, sandy grassland, that even those spaces where we traditionally think about hardscaping, that it would be a softer version of hardscaping. And so if I wanted a patio, it should still be done in a way where water can infiltrate, and maybe even we're thinking about water catchment, for example, to be reused in the environment. I'm thinking about creating shade with trees that can really handle this sandy soil. I'm also thinking really long term. So again, it's very sandy soil now, but I'm planting a number of nitrogen fixing plants so that over the long run, I'll actually increase the fertility of that soil, and I can sort of change and adapt and play with this landscape over a longer period of time. But ultimately, I do want it to fold into to the surrounding environment, and also have room for people. We do need paths. We do need meeting spots. I want a fire pit. I want to some of these social opportunities as well in.
You mentioned water and rain, and catchment area for, so like an underground kind of thing, or what are you thinking about? Because I just one of the sort of new normal, or should we call it the new abnormal things for those of us in the Northeast, from my observation point, I don't know if it's throughout the region, but is that rain comes in dramatic events now. And sometimes it doesn't come at all, but then it comes in inches at a time a lot of times, and with wind a lot of times too. And that's making for, obviously it's harder for soft, gentle rain drains into the soil more easily than 3 inches in a couple of hours. And so is that part of what you're thinking about mitigating? Now you have a fast draining soil, a sandy soil, but are you making this, is it an underground basin, or are you thinking of like a rain garden, or what are you thinking about for that?
You know, it's, for me, it's a combination. And here, Margaret, you're really letting me dream about the future. Gardeners always have those big plans. You know, yeah. One of the things I have in my backyard is this little swale. I think it's a remnant of the construction of the subdivision that I'm in. And there I imagine that being an ephemeral stream at some point. So can I riprap it and sort of slowly allow water to infiltrate into that area? It give me the opportunity then in those areas where I do have drainage issues to push water into that water catchment to become a rain garden. I'm also thinking about the future, and yes, how do I take advantage of this house that I live in that during rain events is a water catchment system? Because I would much rather be storing water that's coming from rain and using that in the garden than using our potable water, which is what we're reliant on at the tap, right? This is water that
right.
is really precious, and it's treated, and it takes a lot of energy in order to create safe drinking water. And it's a little bit of an overuse in our landscapes. And so for us to be able to store it a little bit and then use it over a longer period of time is another way that we're actually improving the quality of our water system.
Right. I love that you said you could riprap it that for about that swale. You know, I haven't heard that expression, riprap, you know, kind of, well, I think of it as like using stones to sort of line either a hillside or, you know, riprap. I don't know, like, I don't even know what the formal definition of it is, but.
You got it. I'm imagining.
Lining it with stone.
Yeah. Yes, I'm imagining a fake a stream that might flow a little bit in the spring. It may hold, it be maybe a water catchment from time to time, and offers a lot of hiding spots, offers a lot of habitat for my local insects and amphibians. And, you know, we are really lucky. We have a backyard that's already regularly visited by bobcats and by foxes, and we really cherish that as a family. And so I want those animals that are in our backyard to be able to benefit as well. So I could imagine them drinking from this little ephemeral space as the water slowly percolates in, migratory birds being able to use it, or lining it even with early and late fruiting plants so that it becomes a resting spot for them.
I like the idea, and I'm trying to make myself be more conscious about this during the rain events, is to go out and look. You know, it's, you know, you don't normally want to go out while it's pouring, but in the aftermath especially. But to really, I think one of the things those of us who are in areas, and there are a lot of regions of the country that are experiencing these downpours and so forth and the effects of it, to observe, like you've observed, that there's this swale, and it might have been the aftermath of construction, as you said, but maybe you could utilize it and enhance it. And I feel like that's one of our big jobs as the climate shifts and as we have these events, these rain events, is to go and look and see what can we do to move the water in a more productive way. And I hadn't thought about storing some of it as much as moving it away from areas where it causes harm or erosion or whatever damage. But I think this is, again, like, I feel like I need to do more forensic investigation, you know what I mean? Of where's the water going nowadays that it's coming, because it's coming in these bigger events. So how's it moving in my property? What can I do, if anything? And I love the like idea of like riprapping some of the, if I were to make a swale or rain garden, I love that, because I think it could also be beautiful and inviting, as you say, to various creatures.
And Margaret, I wonder how you feel about this. And I wonder about your trajectory as a gardener as well. One of the things I've found is that my interest as a gardener really started with curiosity about plants, and then eventually can I keep them alive? But the more I garden, the more I become more interested in the very mundane aspects of it. I'm enamored by, in my vegetable garden, the weeding process. I really enjoy that. I think a lot more about soil than I did 5 or 6 years ago. I'm now thinking about soil on a 2 and 3 year trajectory rather than just as the thing I put the plants into. And I think there's a component of this too, with the habitat is starting to think in time, in longer time periods within the garden. And I'm curious if that's been your experience as a gardener too, that you're becoming a little more focused on maybe the less glamorous aspects of gardens.
I definitely am. And part of it, unfortunately, is because, again, of some of these changes in what was a familiar, the soil was familiar to me, the patterns of weather were more familiar to me. And I've been kind of reawakened in a rude way by these shifts. And for me, as far as the soil and what's worrying me about that, and I don't know if you have them there, where I am and throughout a lot of, I think 38 states are affected now, parts of 38 states, I have the invasive jumping worms, and they degrade the soil so substantially. So having a new version of my old soil is, you know what I mean? It's like having to reacclimate. So for me, that's a particular hot button right now, and I'm trying to feel my way through it.
Yeah, this may be one of the moments where there is a stronger awake for folks who may not already be soil obsessed, where they come to understand how critical it is. I'm absolutely with you. I'm not quite sure what the solutions are yet for jumping worms, but the idea that our soils might be burning through their nutrients faster. We've
Right.
thought of these as the repositories, the things I think about the soil as the thing that I'm investing in so that it can, grow the plants that I want to grow. And as it changes, I almost feel like I've got a family member who's in need of help to try and slow a disease. And I'm not quite sure what to do with that one yet.
No, but I think just like what I was talking about with the rain, just covering our eyes, ears, and just like hear no evil, see no evil isn't going to help. So watching and trying to draw inferences, I think that, and obviously reading the research as it's published and so forth, I think that's going to be important, feeling our way through. And I think this attitude, this mindset that you're talking about being a bioproductive gardener. So in other words, thinking about every step and thinking about every input or every action ahead of time. I think that kind of consciousness, I mean, hopefully that's going to help us to figure out these obstacles, of how to deal with some of these obstacles the best way possible, hopefully. So anything else about bioproductive gardening? Anything else that comes to mind? I mean, I love the idea of, I hadn't even thought of getting a non-petroleum oil for tools. I don't use a chainsaw myself, but for tools and stuff. So, using a cooking oil or a vegetable oil kind of thing. So even that extra quart that you buy can be not petroleum based.
Yeah, I think too, the for me, embracing electric also means a much more pleasant environment when I'm using those tools.
Boy, it's
Electric,
so much less loud, isn't
so
it?
much less noise. You're not generating exhaust fumes that you're breathing in. When you start them up and shut them off, it's much more instantaneous. You don't have that constant revving engine. It does actually just make even the management of our landscapes a lot more enjoyable. I think the big thing too is I always want to make sure that gardeners and people who are exploring new things in with the best intentions, that they feel empowered to step into that space, and that the goal is not to be perfect, it's to just be better. And so there's things that I'm doing and not doing now that 5 years ago felt okay to me. And I just have a different perspective, and it will continue to shift. And that's actually the huge joy of gardening, is that we get to change with it, and it gets to change us.
In the last minute or two, anything else you want to tell us about that, in terms of that's going on, that you're excited about at Native Plant Trust? That, I mean, I'm excited about your sort of native seed project, and you alluded to that before. But that's one that I'm very interested in seeing how that goes.
Yeah, there's a lot to be excited about. Native Plant Trust, before I joined the organization, kind of sent me on this journey of thinking differently. I remember visiting them, visiting Garden in the Woods 6 years ago or so, and seeing their lawn alternative and thinking, that is never going to catch on. And now here I am trying to figure out how to make it work in my own garden. And it was because
Right.
Plant Trust was so far ahead of the curve. I think that part of this bioproductive landscape means that the plants in our gardens should be an extension of the genetics in our communities. And so the Northeast Seed Network is an effort to establish those reliable seed supplies of locally adapted seed for commonly grown plants, and to do it in a way that doesn't mean we're constantly going back to nature and taking seeds, because we don't want to actually disrupt those natural processes either. So
Right.
it's a big project. I think Nisami is a pilot, actually, of how this can be done. And I would love to see a Nisami in every state and every ecoregion throughout New England, but we'll have to wait and see if we can make that happen.
Okay. Well, Tim Johnson, from Native Plant Trust, congratulations again on the new position, and a lot of exciting stuff underway and more to come, I bet. So I hope we'll be in touch throughout the season ahead. And thanks for making time today,
Oh,
to talk.
I really appreciate it. Thank you, Margaret.
Okay, talk to you soon again.
Yes, goodbye.
And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you soon again, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com, and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, offering 30 new seed varieties for 2024. Professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.